Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm attorney Barry Vogel. Some of us may be curious about the vast diversity of plants around the world and perhaps wonder who collects and identifies new species and where we might see them displayed. In this edition of the 2009 Radio Curious Tour of Scotland, we continue and visit with Alan Bennell, Head of Visitor Services at the Royal Botanic Garden, located in Edinburgh, Scotland. Alan Bennell guides us through this horticultural extravaganza and describes how the collection has grown since the garden opened in the 17th century and how the research conducted there is used in conservation efforts around the world. I spoke with Alan Bennell on May 18, 2009, on a windy and rainy day with birds chirping in the background in the Royal Botanic Garden located in Edinburgh, Scotland. We began our conversation when I asked him to introduce himself and the garden. And I ask you, as we listen, to ignore the sounds of the wind and the rain, but do enjoy the chirping of the birds.
My name is Alan Bennell. I'm Head of Visitor Services and have had the privilege of working for the Botanic Garden for over 30 years.
Right here?
Right here. In fact, it's the only job that's ever paid me a salary. I escaped from college back in the mid-70s, came to this delightful place, Britain's oldest national botanic garden, and we have specialities that enable us, because of our protracted history, to reach out across the globe. Although we're rooted in Scotland, the Scots have always been travellers, empire builders on behalf of the British, and we have been at the forefront of identifying plant diversity across the globe. And the lovely thing is, in my time in the garden, it's payback time, because instead of just travelling the globe scouring it for its plants, we're feeding back that knowledge to more than 80 countries across the globe as I speak. And that's a very happy thing to be involved in.
Well, we'll love to hear about it as we walk through the garden.
Okay, I think we should start with a map and get a little bit of orientation, and I'll put the place in context, if you like. We're a mere mile north of the centre of the city of Edinburgh, Scotland's capital, only a mile north, and here on this sanctified plot of land, we've occupied this space since the early 1820s. But there's a previous 150 years of history that found us founded, with sites near Holyrood Palace, where we first began back in 1670, with sites down the ancient road to Leith Docks, the harbour city of Edinburgh, and finally in the 1820s, the collection of plants that had already accumulated over nine and two centuries was migrated here to Edinburgh. And when Scots and indeed international visitors are reminded that on this site we study the world's flora, we are growing plants that represent probably 1 in 14 of all the known plant life on this planet. That's 7% of diversity. And you say, well, hang on, where are you? Scotland's national city? You're 55 degrees north, and yet the climate we enjoy here and the way we've manicured this landscape gives us the perfect environment in which to show things off. And indeed, if you travel Scotland-wide, we are blessed with the diversity of geology, of topography, and of ambient climate, very variable, that allows us to grow such a rich representation of the world's flora.
I think at 55 degrees north, it's important to point out that that is almost as far south as Tierra del Fuego is at the tip of South America.
Absolutely, and if we track across the globe, we'll find we're just about the southern end of Hudson Bay. We're level with some of the hinterland of Siberia, leading across to Kamchatka. The real difference for us is we get the benefit of the ocean stream that flows up, we call it the Gulf Stream, from the Caribbean, off the east coast of North America, and sweeps across the Atlantic, bringing milder conditions than you would otherwise expect at this latitude. And that's what makes it possible for us to cultivate not in subarctic tundra, but essentially gorgeous north boreal climate. The only thing we lack sometimes, and you're getting a bit of it today, is enough sunshine, because in the depths of summer, we're approaching it now, on a good day, at this latitude, we can enjoy nigh on 20 hours of sun. It rises 3 a.m. in the morning, it doesn't set till 10, 11 at night, you can still be out enjoying the good days. But the contrast of that is in the middle of winter, when we're trying to grow tropical plants, there perhaps is only 5 hours of daylight between 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and even that can be grey and ghastly and well below the compensation point for a lot of lush tropical flora. So we can give the plants everything they need except the daylight in winter.
And at that time, you give them the warmth in the glass houses.
We have an area of glass houses covering some couple of acres of a site in total that extends to 70 acres.
Let's go.
Yeah. Each of our 10 plant houses in sequence evoke a particular region or habitat of the world, and you can go from the deserts of Arabia to the tropical forests of South America, and that's what we're going to do. This is the, as it were, the gateway to our undercover collections, and we need them undercover. Most of our plants will survive outdoors in summer, but our winters can get down to minus 10 even. This one is mildly heated to keep an ambient temperature overnight of a minimum of maybe 8 degrees. Centigrade. Just keeps things comfortable, but it means tender tropical rhododendrons, palms soaring into the roof, tropical bamboos, and this is where we focus a lot of our education work. More than 20,000 school kids come here every year, and we can take them on a voyage around the world of plants in one walk through the plant houses, which is what we do. We've now come to much warmer conditions. We're in the jungles of Southeast Asia. Tropical bamboo, you can almost see it grow every day. This is a pandanus, and it's showing all the features that these screw pines do. It's got fantastic prop roots, but if it finds it's growing too close to another plant that's shading it out, it can use the prop roots to build another base. It's a moving plant, if you like. It's walking away to get a bit more light, because in the tropical forests, as you can feel in the canopy of this house today, it's all about finding your pocket of light, which is why everything soars up so much.
It's the walking plants of Costa Rica.
Well, you'll probably know that. Yes, indeed. A lot of new world material in these houses, but I'm going to take you to a part that has some rather special old world. Oh, get the aroma of this. Some of these cycads, the cones, cycads are very primitive plants in the southern hemisphere. There's a few represented in South Africa and in the New World. They're plants that were around at the time of the dinosaurs, and if you feel their leaves, you'll understand why they survived, because they're so tough to withstand browsing and grazing.
They truly are.
They're very primitive plants.
Stronger than cardboard.
Almost locked in a time warp, the cycads are the same as they were thousands of years ago. They haven't evolved much, and there's only relict populations surviving in the wild and in botanic gardens. Brilliant. Well, as we migrate away from the East Gate, you're already seeing rhododendrons. It's a genus that excited the early collectors who went to the Sinai Himalaya. I think you have a couple of species native to the States. Our climate is peculiarly well suited to them, and when you look at any of these plants, what we specialise in contrast to any other garden that holds these collections, we specialise in original wild origin collection. This is a representation of the actual biodiversity you will find in the wild, and that's why our reference collections are so important for the study of all the plants we grow.
In the wild worldwide,
the rhododendrons you'll find here have been gathered from the Sinai Himalaya, China, extending across into Nepal, into Bhutan, into the autonomous region of Tibet. We have some European collections. There's a few rhodies grow there, from the Caucasus in northeastern Turkey, and even representations of Catawbiense, I think, grows in the southern end of the Appalachians as it hits into Texas. And as I say, the difference is it's not cultivated forms out of nurseries. These are original specimens gathered in the wild by our botanists and horticulturists.
Beginning how long ago?
Okay, with a real exploration of these regions, all the early military men, surgeons who travelled with the British Army or the East India Company, many of them were educated, doctors and that. Here they were in stations in exotic parts of the world. Some of them had interests in the ethnography of the peoples. Many of them were excited by the wildlife they saw. And there's this inherent collector in all of us. They had this sense of, oh, that's new, I haven't seen it before. They would start by shooting the birds and sending home a specimen once they tasted it. they would gather samples of the plants. The easiest thing to do was make these classic Victorian press specimen collections. And we've got collections that go back. We've got a Darwin specimen in the herbarium, amongst others. So they go back to the early 1800s and even into the 1700s. But the real exploitation came a few years later with the advent of better travel. And in the 20th century, the last century, beginning of the 20th century, people were clubbing together and sponsoring expeditions to go and collect these forms to bring back seeds so we could grow them in our gardens. A great enterprise. There were Americans, Joseph Rock, who wrote for the National Geographic magazine. He went to the Sino-Himalaya, this rich hotbed of plant life. China has about 50,000 native plants. Here in Scotland, we have about 1,200. So is it any wonder we have always looked beyond our shores to bring in more? And we have, as I said earlier, the fabulous climate in which to grow them. And so it's the early 1900s you began to see this terrific influx of new wild origin material. And it was only at centres like Edinburgh, with its history of collections, with its library, with its preserved collections and the expertise. It's great bringing in new plants, but the first thing people want to know before they can use it is, what is it? Is it different from this? How to categorise it? How to classify it? How to establish where it sits in that great sea of plant biodiversity? And that's what we're all about. So we did the naming. We did the scientific identification. Gardeners the length and breadth of the world, some of them commercially, some of them purely for show, grow the proceeds of what we've been studying.
The plants that you have here, you make their seeds available for distribution?
Primary sine non qua, our purpose in life is we are here to categorize and give a reference to any other plant that other people want to exploit. The freedom we still have to travel the globe and work in various countries is based on the fact we will not commercially exploit. We will pass on the knowledge. So, unfortunately, no, we don't make the rare and beautiful plants we've gathered available. Occasionally, by special license, which we've helped to innovate, we've done recent expeditions to Chile. We found a number of plants in Chile that we think will be great in our gardens. And we have set up earth-shatteringly original, innovative deals in fulfillment of the Rio Convention of 96, which says, okay, for every plant that's sold that's derived from this, we will send back to a conservation project in Chile some remuneration. And that's what we establish with private nurserymen who then profit. Because in contrast, if we'd had to pay, and that includes Northwest American gardens, a cent for every lily, primula, rhododendron, gentian that has enriched our gardens from some of these countries, imagine what would have flowed back. We did it latterly, eventually, for mineral rights. We're now pioneering doing that in the 21st century for the plant life that our gardens would look nothing if we didn't have overseas plants in them. If you look to the right here, you're on the fringes of what many correspondents would describe as the world's greatest rock garden. People differ. Some 2.5 acres with more than 5,400 different species of mountain plants from New Zealand, from Japan, from North America, from the Rockies, above all from the Alps, from the Caucasus. Any mountain range that grows these terrific dwarf gems is represented here, thanks to the travels of our botanists or others who've given us plants. You're looking here up the scree, a lovely colourful tapestry with a whole host of different taxa, and it's a good place to point out what's going on here. What makes a botanic garden a botanic garden? Well, we like to boast that every plant is labelled and properly categorised. And you'll see a little black label on most collections. We give the generic name and the species name. So this is a thyme, a wild mountain thyme from the mountains of North Europe. It's in the family of the labiates, the nettle or mint family. W, it's confirmed wild origin. It's not a cultivated. We do have some cultivated plants. Elspeth McIntosh, one of our Alpine House specialists, she went, collected this, and the collection was made in 2004, and in that year, it was the 1,981st collection put into the Botanic Garden. Should we wander?
Let's wander. And let me say that we are visiting with Alan Bennell, the head of visitor services at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, Scotland. This is Radio Curious on tour, and I'm Barry Vogel.
we're making our way into the heart of the rock garden. And I mentioned some of the alpine gems. Few things are more dramatic than this fabulous blue gentian, Gentiana anacaulis. Behind it is an original collection of our greatest collector. We call him the Indiana Jones of plant collecting, George Forrest. He travelled on no fewer than 7 expeditions to the Sinai Himalaya. He sent back more than 10,000 different living plants, mostly collected as seed. He died on his last expedition shortly after this in 1934, but his contribution to our gardens is unrivaled. It in a way made this garden the specialist home it is for the study of rhododendron. And this is actually one of his collections, his 1,028th collection, sent in 1932 from southwest China. And this is work that carries on. We have a total of about 200 staff here across the Botanic Garden, of whom perhaps some 50 or 60 are what I would call practicing taxonomists, still documenting the diversity of the world. We have a team working on the first ever comprehensive flora of Arabia. We have a team who completed about 5 years ago the first ever documentation of the flora of Bhutan. They've now moved on to collaborate with the Japanese and the Nepalese on creating the first ever documentation of the flora of Nepal.
When these plants were brought here, were the actual plants brought or the seeds?
99% of what we bring in is still seed. And the great challenge the early collectors face, they go out in the spring and see fantastic flowering plants, they tag them. They then have to go back in the autumn to collect seed. We can be much more focused now. We can send a team in for a week. They fly in to Kunming, carry on up into Lijiang, go into the hills, and they'll be working not alone. They'll be working with fellow botanists from Kunming, helping to give an updated documentation of the flora of China. And they'll make a collection like that as seed lots, but with what we call herbarium, these matched pressed reference specimens, so you know what you're relating to.
Can you tell us what attention is given to the area where the plant is grown in its native habitat so that it can be replicated here to propagate the seed?
Above all, we give ourselves a GPS of exactly where it came from. That was something the old collectors couldn't do. These days we can spot every plant we collect in the wild on GPS. Once it comes here, the seeds are sown. We know from global studies a lot about this genus, so we know the conditions it quite likes. And there's a funny thing, and it's a phrase I learnt from one of my education tutors at Oxford, Panglossial optimism. And what it means is that plants can actually grow in far greater tolerance of conditions than just the ones they're pinched down to, because mainly they're forced there by competition. One of our principal drivers, of course, is conservation. Now, nothing is better than conserving the original habitat and conserving the plants in situ. On the other hand, there are certain genera and species of plants that are practically, or indeed are functionally, extinct in their environment. It is no good having one collection like a stamp collection and say, we've preserved it. What you actually need is the geographic variation, which is why in a reference collection like this, we've got samples. We don't just have one example of rhododendron impiditum, but here's a classic. This was collected by one of your American cousins, Joseph Rock, journalist for the National Geographic magazine, lived in Lijiang in the 1930s, and collected ethnographically and botanically. This is his 24,278th collection. They'd have running numbers. So he was out there for about 10, 15 years, gathered in 1933. A certain amount of his material came here to Edinburgh because we knew about rhododendrons, and so inevitably they wanted to get them named by sending them here. Now, that, there'll be other collections of impiditum. That gives us a bit of geographic variation. That isn't a red data book plant because it would have another code on it, but were it so, we would then have enough variation to plan maybe in the future, a dream, to repopulate the wild. If you just had one example and vegetatively propagated it, you have none of that variation. You have no hedge for future evolution.
It's the water wall and the water dropping that we hear in the background at this time.
Absolutely so.
When you speak of the drivers of the garden, who determines the direction and the route?
We have a very simple and very expressive mission statement. Our role as an organization is to explore and explain the world of plants for a better future. That's how we quote it. Sounds punchy, and if I deride that, my role these days, I've done the explore bit, I'm now at the explain end. For our role to be meaningful, we need to communicate it with visitors who come here and with people around the globe. However, what are we really doing here? Fundamentally, we believe all life on this planet depends on the plants. people talk glibly about conserving, the bottom line of conservation is knowing what's here in the first place. And although we pretend we can throw out figures, maybe on this planet there are some 250,000 different forms of higher plant, of those we really have only scientifically known, categorized and understood about 80%. So there's still 20% to be studied, and that's just the higher plants. Conifers, the mosses, the lichens, the ferns, the liverworts, and my once group, the fungi. We know even less about those. So you can't begin to conserve what you don't know about. And we are the part of this family of global National Botanic Gardens who are doing the baseline business of trying to document what plant life there is on this planet so that future generations can make a judgment. Well, we can afford to lose that. We know what the properties of this are, because when you classify, we know the major crop plants that feed half the planet. In the wilds of the jungle somewhere, there may be close relatives that have as yet untapped potential to feed, clothe, give drugs, give medicines to another half of the planet. Unless we, it's easier to say, well, let's conserve it. Somebody's got to tell you what it is. We are one of those institutions like New York Botanic Garden, like Missouri Botanic Garden, like the National Botanic Gardens in Cuba, like the National Botanic Garden in Bogor in Indonesia. Our history makes us one of the preeminent ones. And in anyone's table, one of the top five botanic gardens in the world in terms of their major global outputs and research, Edinburgh is up there. There's a little tract of real Scotland in the corner of a garden that otherwise devotes itself to celebrating the flora of the world. The Scottish flora has a few elements that are quite distinctive. Here we are, Scotland's National Botanic Garden, in a way celebrating the world of plants. But why not devote one little corner that everybody can see to something that is more or less uniquely Scottish? It gives that idea that when you go into the Highlands, so what's special about the Scotch flora? If you stood among it, it would say, well, I'm in Scotland. And it's the heather, some of these scrubby plants, the pines, the birches, the forests, the lovely rowans or sorbus orchiperia, that is a plant that has to be grown in front of every cottage, the little alders, and it's a deliberate evocation. There's even a ruined bothy just through the hills, which is like a shepherd's hut. Some of them have been restored and are used as holiday cottages now, but probably from the 17th century onwards, when folk were out with their flocks and stocks, the building stock was fairly primitive. It would have a thatch roof made from heather and stones or rushes, and it would have rough hewn stone walls, and the attempt just to create a little bit of flavour. Where are you? Well, you're in Scotland, you're not anywhere else. I do believe one or two errant visitors on a fine night have decided to spend the night there, but I wouldn't recommend it. It's quite important to recognise that unless we set an example at home and are actually securing some of the rarer elements of our own flora and celebrating its uses, then what right do we have to go across and go proselytising about, conserve this, don't kill this? Oh yes, we've felled all our forests, so we're now going to tell you not to fell yours. And so the Botanic Garden does have a principal role in Scotland. We are the source of knowledge of all plant biodiversity in Scotland, so if somebody wants to know the rare lichens, the rare fungi, even the rare plants, where they are, what they are, the natural heritage organisations will come to us for that authoritative information. And what we've tried to do in this part of the garden is not only celebrate that with plants, but a few very simple narratives in the Scottish Feast Garden, reminding people, so here's a willow, it got its common Gaelic name, and a little bit of information about how people used to use it, and indeed crafts that are still there. And the narrative here, so the willow was the source of ancient aspirin.
And even with the willow here, there's a dance, Strip the Willow.
Hey, absolutely, yeah, jolly good Cayley dance. Cayley is a traditional evening of music, dance and song. And of course it's fueled by consumption of prodigious quantities of whiskey of egg. Whiskey, as you know it, the water of life. And why not? You've been trekking around Scotland. You've seen, I think, one of the greatest plant biodiversities we have. One of our most sensitive raw materials is our peat, and it's the peat that often gives some of the best flavour to our whiskies, and with more than 120 different distilleries still producing, one or two individual new ones coming, each of those in its single malt will offer you a different flavour. And there is no finer botanical product. Barley, the malt, a fungus, one of my botanical specimens, producing it and flavouring from the peat. one of the finest regional products you can sample. Forget these blended whiskies. Go and taste the real malt, and as you do, maybe enjoy the native flora nearby. And there might even be a ruined bothy and a peaty pool like this.
And what are some of your favorite whiskies?
How long have you got? One of my deepest joys in coming to Scotland 30-odd years ago was, wow, 400 miles nearer the mountains, 400 miles nearer the distilleries. There's a whiskey for all occasions. I'm particularly fond of some of the Speysides, which are the more traditional whiskies, and there's a wonderful form that bears my name, Mac Allen, son of Allen. It's a lovely sherried malt from near Ducktown, and Macallan is very fine. On the other hand, my heart lies in the islands, and when you get to the island of Skye, it's fantastic. Talisker is unbelievably good. There's Whiskey Island, as I call it, the island of Islay, where there are now 8 operating distilleries, and they are particularly peated. The most strongly peated are Lagavulin and Ardbeg on the southern shore. When you get tasting notes of these whiskies, people are talking about licking tires and smoking rubber on the beach. But it's all there, this wonderful complexity of flavors. I'm going to throw one more in. I think perhaps the finest whiskey in the world. The island of Orkney. There are 2 distilleries there, Scarpa and Highland Park. Very well-known form. It goes into many other whiskies as part of the blend. Highland Park, the standard release, is a 10 or I think it's a 12-year-old. Seek out the 18-year-old Highland Park. It's been mature that little bit long. You can mature too long and just pay for the rarity and the price. The 18-year-old Highland Park, many, many correspondents will agree, it is the absolute emperor of whiskies.
Alan Bunnell, Head of Visitor Services for the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, we want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious on tour in Edinburgh, Scotland. And before we close, we have 2 questions we like to ask everyone. One of them is there a eureka or an aha moment on any topic in your experience that's come to you recently?
I fear that almost every day when I walk into this institution, there's a eureka moment. There's always another plant that's just opened up. There's always a piece of news or a story that we want to promulgate. And as you can perhaps tell from my enthusiasm, life is so full of eureka moments, it will be unfair to throw you one. My real eureka moment might just be when I get an invitation to visit California, which I haven't done yet, and I see those giant redwoods for real. I'm looking forward to that.
Well, we would love for you to come. The other question is, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, given my antiquity, I'm now in my late 50s. Sometimes the music track to my life has been sung by Bob Dylan, and I am so enjoying reading the sort of collected, the diaries, a number of early tomes that have been published recently, just talking about his inspiration. You can overpraise the man's poetry. At the end of the world, he has a phrase or a word for every day. Recently, we've staged an exhibition inspired by the legends of Hard Rain that were captured by a photographer who worked alongside us here in the Botanic Garden to celebrate every stanza of Hard Rain, depicting the impact of man on our planet. And it was one of the most popular exhibitions we've had in the gardens in the last 4 years. And so it's been a bit of the soundtrack to my life. So reading those chronicles, that's pretty inspiring.
Alan Bunnell, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
My privilege.
This interview with Alan Bunnell, Head of Visitor Services at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, Scotland, was recorded on May 18, 2009, a windy and rainy day amid birds enjoying the life in a most beautiful place. The book Alan Bunnell recommends is The Chronicles of Bob Dylan by You Know Who. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format. To get a copy, visit our website for further details. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.